In the writings of St. Ambrose of Milan and John Cassian, we find the continued life of Cicero's De Amicitia applied to a specifically Christian context. Both of these authors knew and cite Cicero's writings and indicate to us how this classical exposition of friendship is now being applied in the particular context of Christian ministry, in the case of Ambrose, and Christian community, in the case of Cassian. As we'll see, Ambrose is concerned that the ideal of friendship is an important characteristic and goal, and indeed support for all of those involved in ministry. They should have friends. And also in the context of Cassian's description of religious community, he'll speak from his own experience of his profound friendship with Germanus, his friend from his early monastic life, as a paradigm of Christian friendship and friendship in community, but also as a kind of a starting off point for an emphasis on the danger of anger, because as we'll see, Cassian's reflections are almost overwhelmingly concerned with how the experience of friendship can be for us a constant reminder of the need to suppress and avoid our anger with others, lest we disrupt or destroy important relationships. Let's look first at Ambrose's text. Here again, in the context of clerical life, before he begins to cite from Cicero, he gives an example drawn from the Old Testament. Queen Esther, for example, the one who is able to, as it were, be a friend of the people of Israel and risk danger to herself. And he then goes on to offer the example of Jonathan and Abimelech in section 124. All of these by way of introduction so that the notion of friendship can be rooted in a pre-existing religious tradition with which Christians would be familiar. And as we'll see, he first begins to quote from Cicero in number 124 when he says that friendship is not to be preferred to virtue, but indeed it follows after virtue. It is the fruit, as it were, of virtue. Virtue is the source of, or the cause of, or it is the basis of a developing friendship. Then, in chapter 22 of his De Officiis, beginning with number 125, he borrows from very select portions of Cicero and adapts them. And it's interesting to note the portions that he borrows. The first is that, as I've highlighted in the blue bar, that there can be no compromise in virtue, that nothing should be set up before virtue. It should never be set aside by the desire for friendship. So the fact that friendship is a desirable good should never cause one to forget the fact that it is necessarily rooted in the experience of one who is living holiness of life from the context of the Christian tradition, one who is genuinely seeking Christian virtue. Then a characteristic of this and a kind of a test of it is found in Numbers 126 and 127, in which he borrows from a tradition we've already seen in Cicero and particularly emphasizes that if a true friendship exists, one in which virtue is the basis, then correction will be necessarily accepted. And this is his answer to the controversy, which he notes is discussed in other contexts and philosophical texts, whether or not a person, for the sake of friendship, can engage in an act which is itself morally wrong. Well, Ambrose's answer to this, of course, is no. And effectively what he's saying is, if friends accept correction, and they do, and if the friendship is based on virtue, then if your friend wants you to do something wrong, you should correct that person, and that person will accept your correction if they are a good friend. So true friends, he says, true witness is required so that a friend may not be assailed by the treachery of a friend by whose good faith he ought to be acquitted. A man ought never to please a friend who desires evil or to plot against one who is innocent. So friendship is never an excuse for doing something that is wrong, and indeed, friendship should be a reason for objecting to and correcting one who intends to engage in wrong. And so in number 127, when one knows the fault of anyone who is a friend, one ought to rebuke him, and that rebuke ought to be accepted with gentleness. And again, he's quoting both Proverbs and Cicero in this context. Then in number 128, a series of apothegmata, a very beautiful little succinct statements that indicate what for him is the real goal of friendship or the duty of friendship. And in friendship, he says, one should, one can, one must open your breast to a friend. Aperi pectus tuum amico. Open your innermost self, your heart to a friend, that that person may be faithful to you and that you may receive from him the delight of your life. So the openness and honesty which friendship permits and invites is itself a source of great grace, according to Ambrose. Then the next statement, give way to your friend as to an equal. Defer amico ut equali. So there is an acknowledgement of the right of the other to be regarded as first. And here again, it's a kind of a corollary of his principle of the rights of friends to offer fraternal correction. Do not be ashamed to anticipate your friend in showing courtesy or in doing kindness. So he then says, do not desert a friend in time of need, nor forsake him or fail him. For friendship is the support of life. So even when friendship becomes difficult, it should be maintained. And he accentuates that in the beginning of number 129, where he says, if necessary, we should tolerate even aspera, hardships, difficult circumstances, for the sake of a friend. Then he gives the example in number 130 of Job. So it's very clear that for Ambrose, one of the chief duties of friendship is openness and honesty about precisely that area of virtue which is supposed to be the basis or the source of the friendship, a willingness to communicate it, to correct and to receive correction, and to be absolutely above board, absolutely open with the other individual. One can begin to see a kind of therapeutic quality to this, which is already present in Aristotle and Cicero, but which is being emphasized here, that when you have that person in your life, it also means that your own virtue will be strengthened. He mentions in number 131 the importance of perseverance, of continuation in a relationship, even when it becomes difficult. And he gives the example of Saul and Jonathan, which are models for David, who is reputed as having been friend of both, and David's own statement in that regard. Then in number 132, equality, the experience that friendship is a kind of a leveling of social inequality. This is something that Ambrose also wants to emphasize. Then in 134 and 135, he returns again to this principle of openness and of honesty. For him, this is a principal characteristic of it. One can begin to see that he is looking at the model of friendship as something which also invites an openness, an honesty, and integrity in regard to the spiritual life that is of relevance to the notion of being open to one's spiritual father or one's spiritual mother. That's not what he's saying. That's not the context. But again, he is speaking to people in ecclesiastical authority, inviting them to have someone in their life for whom they can be this. And in number 135, towards the end, a highlighted text, which is a very classical one and ends up being quoted again and again in the tradition. A friend then, if he is a true one, hides nothing. Nihil occultat amicus. The friend does not keep things secret. He pours forth his soul. Effundit animum suum. So there is and I've called it here, a kind of a kenotic outpouring. There is an outpouring or a radical honesty on the part of the self in regard to the relationship with the friend. And the example of Christ is invoked as the Lord Jesus poured forth the mysteries of his Father. So there's an openness in regard to one's own innermost life in the presence of a friend that is like Christ's willingness to share the secrets, the mysteries of heaven. An interesting application in the Christian context of this notion of openness, which is already present in the earlier models. But here it almost reaches the point of being an expectation or a kind of a test or a discipline within the context of friendship. Now, that's as much as Ambrose has to offer us in the area of friendship. Several decades later, John Cashin writes Conference 16 in the, as it were, safe retreat of his work with the monasteries of Loran in Gaul, having lived many years before in Egypt, and having traveled around to the various abbas of Egypt, drawn from their wisdom, now sorting it out and trying to organize it thematically, he reflects also on the fact that he was not alone in this journey. He was present in his movements with his friend Germanus, who had been with him since the very beginning of their monastic peregrinations, starting out in Palestine and then moving into Egypt. We don't know how Germanus disappears from the scene, whether he assumes an ecclesiastical responsibility or whether he dies. Cassian doesn't give us any information on this subject. It's very intriguing the amount of time that Cassian spends in the area of anger and its destructive potential for friendship. One wonders whether he is speaking out of his experience of relationship with Germanus, his own sense of the perhaps delicacy of their own relationship in certain areas, but that would be speculative and there's no way of determining this. But it is interesting that in this conference, which begins with a reflection on that friendship, the overwhelming emphasis in it, and this is not the complete text of the conference, I've removed quite a lot dealing with details of how important it is to keep one's anger in check, that this is so extremely thematic. Notice then in chapter 1 he speaks of Abba Joseph, who, having discovered that Germanus and Cassian had been friends for many years, decides to give a conference on friendship. So he's attributing this conference to Abba Joseph, but as we'll see, the themes that are commonly drawn from Cicero are present here. Although in a fashion that is very typical of Cassian, he expands on the existing models, and so there are not only two lesser forms of friendship, but as we'll see, four. And so in chapter 2, section 2.1, he says, there are many different kinds of friendship and companionship. The first involves a previous recommendation. Someone has suggested that we enter into a relationship with someone, and over time it begins to develop. Another relates to a bargain or an agreement, a contractus, an agreed upon contract. The third is a similarity of business or of science or art of study. And the third has to do with familial roles, where one is bound to another person by the natural tie of being a relative. So rather than just the two notions of inferior forms of friendship being based on utility or on desire, he's introduced these four categories. And rather than condemning them, he just says that all of these kinds, which are common to both good and bad, they can be engaged in by good people or bad, and indeed one can even see particularly the protection of relatives as common with non-human species. He says they certainly cannot last forever. So they are temporal, but there is, he says in chapter 3, and again a theme that we've seen now several times, an indissoluble or almost eternal friendship, and that is one based on similarity of virtue, similitudo virtutum. So that for him is the basis for the most appropriate and highest form of friendship, that one have a common vision of virtue. Each sees in the other that which each is striving for. So he describes it as a true and unbroken love, growing by means of a double perfection and goodness of friends. And he says, which no difference of liking or nor disturbing opposition of wishes can sever. This is, of course, a goal to be achieved, something to be worked at, so that one maintains the same goal. If we drop down then to number 3.5, he says that it involves a unity of spirit rather than of place. Non localiter sed spiritualiter. That is to say, he's disagreeing slightly with the Aristotelian notion of the almost necessity for community in order to develop this idea of friendship. Remember, his is a peripatetic friendship, not a peripatetic in the strict sense of being Aristotelian, but in the sense of moving around. He and Germanus are not stable in a particular place, and the idea is here of a friendship that is not confined to a particular locale. So it isn't necessary, he says, to reside in a particular location for friendship to grow. Then in chapter 4, the question is asked, what if One wants to do something that seems to be useful and profitable. Should it be done against the wish of the brother? Well, here Cassian applies the notion of the goodness of virtue as the basis for friendship, the question of whether a friendship can introduce a disharmony of a proposed course of action. And for him, of course, that raises the question of discernment. Here the other becomes an opportunity for one to discern what should be done. And so he says, full and perfect grace of friendship can only last among those who are perfect and of equal goodness. Like-mindedness and common purpose allows them never, well, or at any rate, hardly ever, to disagree or to differ in the matters which concern their progress in the spiritual life. So there will be a giving way to the better vision of the other, which is, as we've seen, part of a theme in Cassian in the area of discernment. The discernment is never, I decide what to do on my own, but I decide what to do by laying it before another whom I trust. And so effectively here, friendship for Cassian is precisely that. I am placing the question before another or experiencing their issue, their suggestion, as an opportunity for me to practice a sort of discernment. And so the foundation for all of this, he says in chapter 6, is number 1, a contempt for worldly substance, for desiring worldly things. The second is a willingness to prune one's own wishes, as it were, to give way to the other. The third, to recognize that everything must come after the blessing of love and peace. You can see where all of this is leading, that for him, the question of whether someone wants to do something and it is virtuous, but you don't want to, will, in Cassian's model, suggest strongly that you need to conform your wishes to the other. And the fifth, to cure any wrath which a brother may have conceived against him, however unreasonably. So at this point, we've moved out of the context of friendship and into the context of life in community. And Cassian washes back and forth between these two realities in a way that can be rather subtle, or which seems to be in some cases perhaps a little unguarded. At one point he's talking about how you give way to a friend, at another that you should never allow anyone else in community to have wrath against you. So the ideal of friendship, which is only rarely found in relationships, nonetheless provides a kind of a model for or a goal in which one strives, according to which one strives within the context even of a community in which friendship may be minimally present or may not be present. So the last characteristic, which is important in the preserving of union, and although he's implying that this is connected with friendship, there's also here a clear suggestion that this has to do with the union of community itself, is to realize daily that he is to pass away from this world. There is to be an eschatological dimension, an awareness of the fact that our giving way to the other is for the sake of a life, a relationship that reaches out into eternity. And again in number 6.3, to repress all the motions of lusts and sins of the heart. Then in chapter 7, he is speaking more broadly and again stepping out of the context of friendship and rather more broadly into community, how nothing should be put before love or after anger. All things, however useful or necessary they may seem, should be disregarded, that disturbing anger may be avoided. So for Cassian, the issue of friendship or of unanimity in community is paramount and must not be imperiled by outbursts of angry behavior. And thus, in number 10, none of us should trust to his own judgments more than his brother's. Otherwise you'll be deceived, he says, by the devil. And in the next chapter, number 11, each may think more of the knowledge and holiness of his partner and hold that the better part of discretion is to be found in the judgment of another rather than his own. Honore alter utrum prevenientes. This is also found in chapter 72 of Benedict's Rule, a giving way to one another in honor. Then he describes in chapter 14 the theme of an objection to friendship. Well, isn't having, if you will, a specific individual whom you love because of this particular virtue that you see in them and they in you, isn't that somehow inimical to or destructive of that fraternal love that one should have with everyone. And he tries to distinguish by saying that it's possible to show everyone the love that is called agape. Christ invites all of us to have love for all. And even an enemy is to be loved this way. And we'll see that Elrid picks up on this theme, as does Gregory the Great. But diathesis, and he uses a particular term here for affection, is to be shown to but a few, and to those of us who are united by kindred dispositions or a tie of goodness. And he uses, of course, the example of John the Evangelist. John, the beloved disciple, he says in 14:3, is loved in a particular way by Christ. Therefore, we may have relationships in which we see a particular form of virtue in another, and it evokes within us a sympathy which is different from and creates a relationship that is qualitatively different from that relationship which we have with others, but which is characterized by agape and love. So he then goes on in number 15 to, and indeed for the rest of this chapter, to talk about the perversions of monastic discipline in a way that only destroys friendship or community. For example, silence can be used as a way of hiding one's anger at another, and so it's a kind of a false silence. So he says in number 15, there are those who hide the fact that they know that someone has a grievance against them, and they engage in acts that seem to be pious. Instead of going to the one who's caused the problem, and as he puts it, smoothing it down, instead these people begin to sing the psalms, engaging in acts of piety. And in number 18, he speaks specifically of a silence that enrages, a sullen or scornful silence, not just as in the previous chapter, a refusal to go to the brethren and keep silence in that way, but a silence that is specifically the silent treatment, as it were, which causes more anger than, he says, angry reproaches might. And there's a kind of a misuse of fasting in the same way. Oh, I can't eat because I'm working through something, which is another way of saying I'm having trouble with you. And he says this is a kind of sacrilege, using the beautiful gift of fasting in an inappropriate and effectively destructive kind of way. And in number 20, even a feigned patience, which is a way of interacting in a negative way with the other individual. So he says in number 27, we ought to restrain every movement, every expression of anger, especially its expression in these twisted or perverse or pseudo-religious kinds of ways, under the direction of discretion, which for him is giving way to the other. And the model instead in 27:4 is that the heart should be enlarged and opened wide, the theme we've already seen at the end of the prologue of Benedict's Rule. So he then concludes, or at least this section concludes, with the notion of friendship, which has to have a holy origin and cannot be based on a notion of conspiracy. It won't have any kind of harmony to it. So in Cassian we see the use of the model of friendship, which is both applied to that specific context of those whom one is uniquely called to love as exemplars of virtue, but also as a kind of a prototype, a model from which we then can discern rules for or methods that help us in the living out of our community life in a spirit of charity and of compassion.